Seating hairline, Yeshiva Bacher. Show us the room.
Let's go. I have another second to start.
Okay, you're a Yeshiva Bacher. You're a Yeshiva Bacher. Let's go. Go stand. Shh. Okay, guys, seriously. The only rule is no talking. You got to talk. A lot of space outside to talk. Okay, listen, sleep, other things, daydream, but talking is going to disturb the focus. So Parshas Vayishlach describes the continuing travails of Yaakov Avinu as he once again confronts Esav, and he thought that he had finished because he had escaped Lavan and had eluded Esav, and once again he's thrust right back into that challenge with Esav HaRasha, and he sees 400 people, and he wins and he defeats Esav, and he defeats the mysterious angel who wrestles with him in the middle of the night, and his name changes. Remember, name changes in Sefer Bereishis are formative because they demonstrate the Avos are growing into new positions and new roles. Avram switches to Avraham Avinu, Avamon Goyim, and his name shifts. And Yaakov's name shifts in Parshas Vayishlach. From the name of Yaakov, I'll just turn this off, from the name of struggle, Vyodoa Chesus, who was named Yaakov because he struggled to try to achieve what wasn't naturally his. He wasn't naturally born as the predetermined, predestined one to be chosen. He had to struggle to achieve it. And part of that struggle was demonstrated by holding on to the heel of Esav. And part of that struggle was demonstrated that he had to somehow manipulate the brachos away from Esav, and each of those moments are captured by the word Yaakov. But now in Parshas Vayishlach he's called Yisrael. And the shift from Yaakov into Yisrael is a shift on a personal level, from his period of struggle to his period of triumph. It's also a shift in the history of Am Yisrael. Because when we live in Golos, when we struggle with history, when we haven't reached the end point, when we're still marching through this thing called history, we're called Yaakov. One day we'll be referred to as Yisrael. We'll be permanent. You'll all be here. You won't be traveling here for 3 months. You'll all live here. Beis HaMikdash won't be here. There will be no Johannesburg. There won't even be a United States. It will all be in Israel. Matovu Olecha Yaakov, Mishkin Osecha Yisrael. When we're still temporary, our tents that are temporary refer to as the tents of Yaakov. But when we build Mishkan, when we build a sanctuary, when we build a building that's permanent, and Mishkan here is more permanent than Ohel, Mishkin Osecha Yisrael. So you'd think that it's all finished. The entire parsha should be wrapped up nicely, and we should move headlong into parshas Vayeshev, children, who will be the leader. Remember, parshas Toldos is number 6, parshas Vayetze is number 7. Sefer Bereishis is 12 parshas. And you think there'd be a natural division. The first 6, the saga of the Avos, Avraham, Yitzchak, and Yaakov, selecting the good from the bad, the virtuous from the evil, Kibi Yitzchak from Ishmael, Yaakov from Esav. And now, we should shift, now that no one's being deselected, no one's being discarded, everyone is part of Am Yisrael in the end of Sefer Bereishis. It's not a question of choosing one from the other, but who will be the leader? Okay, Yosef, Yehuda, Reuven, who will lead all these chosen people? And then all of a sudden there's a strange ending to Parshas Vayishlach. Because Yaakov is successful, and he navigates the storm of Dina, and we're going to start with this. Take a look at the end, okay? The end, source number 4, we're going to start with the end, okay? Source number 4, I only quoted for you about 4 or 5 psukim. But if anyone has a chumash, I don't have it in front of me. This parak, parak Lamed Vav, which is the chapter with which Parshas Vayishlach ends, you look it up in your chumash, is 50 plus psukim. 50 plus psukim. You know, you're a Valkyria, you're Bar Mitzvah. How many psukim, Bar Mi Parsha?
15.
Bar Mi means Bar Mitzvah in English. How many? 54 psukim describing nothing. We make fun of every culture, don't we? I'll get around to it. 54 psukim describing nothing. No angels, no wars, no visitations, no ladders, not even sheep. Nothing. Let's look at source number 4, part Beis. The Eila told us Esav hu Edom. 54 psukim describing the children of Esav. Do any of you know these people? I don't. Esav lakach es nashab mibnos Kenan. Who were his wives? Es Ada bas Elon Hachiti, Ada, Ahalivama bas Ana bas Tzivon Hachivi. Anyone know girls named Ada or Ahalivama? We don't name our kids after Esav's wives or Esav's children. or all the rest of the things that are being described in these psukim? Why do we have 54 psukim describing all the wives of Esav, all the children of Esav, names that are meaningless? Guys, there are entire mesechtos in Shas with levels and layers of halachos that are based on one extra letter here or there in a parsha. Because the Torah is very, very careful about not wasting words. Every word, every letter is delivered from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. The Gemara Menachos says, Rabbi Akiva went up to Shemayim and saw the Rabbanu Shalom putting crowns on top of letters. And each crown, you know what we call crowns in Hebrew? Tagin. Tagin. And which letters typically have crowns? There are seven letters that typically have crowns in a Sefer Torah, Tefillin and Mezuzah. Shin. Ayin. Tet. Nun Zion, Gimel Tzadik. They're called, just to remember them by an acronym, Shatnez, which everyone knows the word Shatnez, Shin Ayin Tes Nun Zion, Getz, Gimel Tzadik. So if you want to remember which letters have Tagin, Shatnez, Getz. So every little crown, how you draw the crown, which direction the crown is facing, can trigger mounds and reams of halacha. And here the Torah wastes 54 psukim on nothing. And as I've told you before in this year, some of the most important parts of Sefer Bereishis is when the Torah wastes its verbiage on nothing. Remember Chayisara, all that discussion about Eliezer, which we read his story twice as it happens and as he retells it. This is another moment in Bereishis where the Torah wastes its words. Why so much of a discussion about Aholivama and Ada and Sivon and Achos Nevaios and Basmas, names that mean nothing to us, not even know their names, even your Bar Mitzvah Parsha. Buzz willing to know what those names mean. So part of the reason is what Rashi says. If you look careful, you'll see some of the names repeating themselves because, excuse me for saying this, and there are younger kids here, so I won't use the official word, but I'll just describe it abstractly. Esav and his family weren't exactly sexually, let's call it normal. There's a lot of deviance in the family. Parents marrying children, finding out that your mother was also your aunt and your mother was also your sister, and all sorts of crazy, crazy Yevamos-like arrangements. The only thing in mind Yevamos can dream up. And every day when you say three times, Aleinu l'shabach l'adon hakol, and you say, Shelo asanu k'goyei haratzos, first of all, you're thanking Hashem for who we are as a people, our culture, our ethics, our belief system, but you're also thanking HaKadosh Baruch Hu, Shelo Asanu K'Mishpachos HaAdama. There's something called the Jewish family, and so many of the halachos about Isuri Erva in Parshas Kedoshim, in Parshas Acharemos, that we read about on Yom Kippur itself, have to do with making sure that as men and women live together under one roof, there isn't the types of sexual deviances that are so distasteful, that are so destructive to society, that are so dangerous even genealogically. Unfortunately, part of, not the only reason, the real reason the Torah made sexual deviation in the family setting, what is known as incest, us, is because, you know, it's likely when people live under such close quarters, remember, you guys are all living in large, spacious homes. Some of the South African boys can talk to large, spacious homes. Plenty. We're going to get there. Plenty of space for everyone. You live on one part of the street. Your grandparents live on another part of the street. It was not uncommon. I'm not talking about 5,000 years ago. I'm talking about 500 years ago for extended families to live under one roof. Three generations. And when I say lived under one roof, they didn't live in a mansion, first floor, second floor, and third floor. Your house was two rooms, if you were lucky. You know, if you were affluent, your house was two rooms. A place to eat and a place for everyone to sleep. That's all it was, two rooms. In most cases, it was one room. And you just moved away the kitchen table, everyone brought out their straw mattress and slept there. That's how people lived. And human nature is weak and human nature is vulnerable. Star says, these are basic severe issurim that have to be avoided. And this is a level of how we conduct ourselves initially in marital affairs. And in Mirz Hashem, you'll find out, part of the problem when you're in high school, I'm talking to high school boys now as well, boys who were in high school, is because in your world you're flooded with sexual imagery and you're sexually stimulated, but then what happens is you're not really expected to marry till 20, 21, 22, 23. So you've got this 10-year gap with your feelings, but it's not appropriate to act upon those feelings. So the easiest way to stop you from indulging in those feelings is to say it's tamei and it's treif, and it's ugly, and it's the Yetzirah. Chalil v'chas. These are tremendous gifts that Kadosh Baruch Hu gave you that will one day allow you to have a healthy family life, Meir Hashem, a beautiful, blissful marriage. You'll be attracted to your wife. She'll be attracted to you. You'll express deep, deep, intimate secrets to each other and live in a way and can communicate in a way that you don't communicate to anyone else. If you don't have that trait, it's a real rachmanis. Unfortunately, the people who don't have that trait, we talked about this in my shiur, it's a real rachmanis in those people. Shelo asano ki goye haratzos velo samano ki mishpachos ha'adama. Right now may not be the time, but even halachas such as negiyah shel chiba, you know, in modern Western, so to speak, modern Orthodox culture, whatever you call that, there is a bit of a slippage. Ideally, you shouldn't kiss your grandmother. Ideally, the only female you should be kissing is your daughter, your sister, obviously your wife. Okay, I wouldn't be makbir on that. You know, I wouldn't be makbir on such things. Most people are makbir, but certainly with aunts. And again, if aunts want to give you a kiss, I wouldn't create a covenant of brios issue. I spoke to many gedolim about this. I wouldn't slap her in the face and say, I'm not going to kiss you. But assuming your aunt is someone that you can, you know, knows halacha and is sensitive to Torah, the ideal is even things such as kisses, which aren't sexually stimulating, even those shows of affection, ideally, and not anyone that should go back to Johannesburg or the K, whatever, stop. Don't make a big deal about it, but one day when you're an uncle, so you're not supposed to go ahead and kiss your niece or your sister, your daughter, your wife. With grandparents, it's a little bit vague, okay? So if you want to kiss your granddaughter one day, you want to kiss your grandmother, I won't make a big stink about it, but just you should at least know what the ideal is. The ideal is that that's not something that should be engaged in, and you can express love and commitment and connection, even with Baruch Hashem, like great relationships with my grandmother, and there's never something, oh, you're not kissing me, you don't love me. It's just a question of tznius. It's a question of taras ha-mishpacha. Shelo asanu kigoy ha-ratzos, shelo samanu. Last week, the boys in Grush can tell you, 2 weeks ago, there was a team of South Korean filmmakers that came to the yeshiva. Why? Because in South Korea, they've discovered that the Jews are very smart. And they're trying to replicate that smarts in their own curriculum. So they're saying, why are the Jews so smart? It must be because they learn Gemara. So now in South Korea, all the high school kids learn Gemara. So they came to Gush to interview the boys about learning Gemara. Another thing that Jews are known for, and I don't have to tell you, in all of your cultures, in England, in the United States, in South Africa, is the solidity of the family structure. The Jewish family, you know, the guy, let's go marry a Jewish boy. We don't want them to because it's intermarriage. But they want to marry Jewish boys. Why? Because they'll build a good family. They're not going to abandon their children. They're not going to abandon their wives. And Shalom, Sanu, Kigai, Erosus, and you read about the disaster of Esav, of parents marrying children, marrying grandma, whatever. You can read and look in Rashi. I don't have to give you the calculus now. You should be proud that part of what we've given to society, part of what we're known for, is how to build a Jewish family, how to build festivals, how to come together for Shabbos. There's something to be said about Shabbos. Obviously, Shabbos is metaphysical and it's theological. You don't travel on Shabbos because Hashem didn't work on Shabbos, and you want to remind yourself and try to be like a Kodesh Baruch Hu. But part of it is that means that when you come for Shabbos to be with your parents, to be with your children, you stay for 24 hours. You don't eat and run. Imagine if we all ate and run, we came for Friday night dinner, and then drove home. So we wouldn't be stuck living with the family under the same roof for 24 hours or during a 3-day Yom Tov for 72 hours straight. But that builds survival skills, right? You have to live together with your entire family for 3 straight days. That means you realize the importance of family. Like it or leave it, whether you'd rather be with them or not be with them, you have to be with them on Shabbos. You have to. And that's something that we look to as a value, as a benefit, a side benefit of Shabbos. So that's part of the message at the end of a Yishlach. What a family is meant to be like. You know, the legal part of it is obviously these Isuri Erva, but the more symbolic and meaningful issue is not just the technical legal Isuri Erva, but just what it means to have a Jewish family. But there's another reason that's more historic and less personal. And I want you to listen carefully, because this is the main theme of tonight's show. We'll discuss other things, but every night there's one main theme. This is the main theme. Okay? Source number Gimel. Amidst those 54 meaningless psukim, there are two that perhaps, source Gimel part 4, that perhaps carry the message. Source Gimel part 4. Vayikach Esav es Nasha. So after he has all of his children and his wives, he takes them, v'es Banav and his children, v'es Benosav and his daughters, v'es Kol Nafshos Beis, so look inside source Gimel, v'es Mikneo, his cattle, and all his animals, and all his possessions. Very long list, guys, right? one of the longest lists in Sefer Bereishis. Avram also had children, wives, but the list isn't as deliberate. Here the list is very, very detailed. His sons, his daughters, Nachshon's Beso, his cattle, his animals, his possessions that he purchased. So there's obviously something up here. There's something strange here. Be'eretz Kenan, Vayelech El Eretz, he goes to a land. Where does he go to? It's some unknown, mysterious land. We know where he goes. He goes to Seir. But the Torah doesn't tell us. The Torah says he goes to a land. Mipnei Yaakov Achiv, because of his brother Yaakov. Where is he going? What role does Yaakov have? Why is there a detailed list of sons, daughters, cattle, animals? What's going on? And the next pasuk makes the mystery even more oblique, even more strange. Ki hayarech husham merav mishevas yachdav. So there's a little bit of an explanation. There are too many cattle. It sounds like Avram and Lot. They couldn't coexist. But now it's a little... V'lo yachla eretz megurehem laseis osam mipnei miknehem. The land of their fathers, the land where their fathers lived, could not carry them. Well, that sounds biblical. Land carrying people? Just say, they had too many cattle. Well, no, they each needed grazing land. The land of their fathers couldn't carry them together. Something's up here, guys. Esav isn't just leaving because he's looking for pasture land. He's going somewhere. Where he's going is obviously not as important as where he's running from. Yaakov has some role. He's taking all of his family. Where is he going? Why is he going? And why is it important for us to know he's taking his family? So to me, guys, this is probably one of the most important Rashis for you to hear this year, and certainly the guys who are going back to Job or back to Cape Town this week, right? End of the week? When is your fire open? Morning. Are you going back soon? Think about this Rashi. Rashi says, source number Dalit. Quotes a Medrash, line 2. Medrash Agada. Mipnei Yaakov Achiv, where was Esav running? It's not because of Yaakov. Listen to these words carefully. It's a really important message about how to live Israel in your life. Because when the land was given to Avram, to Yitzchak, and to Yaakov, it was given with a challenge. It's not just a land of benefit and of privilege, and of milk and honey, and of stars and of sand. It's also a land of struggle. Remember Hashem told Avram, your children will be strangers. Their presence in this land will be contested. Everyone will know this is the gateway to heaven. No one will let them live there peacefully. Why do you think Yerushalayim is so contested? It's not incidental. Everyone knows this is where history will be played out. This is the epicenter of the world. And if Jews are in this land, it has to be protested. It has to be campaigned against. It has to make front page of every single newspaper across the world. Avram knew this. Yitzchak knew this. Yaakov knew this. That the land carried a shtar chov, a debt, an obligation, a mission. And Esav knew this also, and Esav had the choice to remain in Israel, and if he remained in Israel, he would have been part of redemptive history. He would have been part of the Jewish people. He and Yaakov would have teamed up. But Esav flinched. Esav fled. Esav took a pass. Esav said, listen to what Esav said. Amar, he says, line 3, source Dalit. Look at line 3. Eilech li mikan, I have to get out of this land. I don't care where I'm going, I just have to leave. Torah doesn't tell us where he's going because he's running. He's running from Israel. I don't care where I go. I just have to get out of this land. Eilech li mikan. Why? Ein li chelek. I don't want to have any portion, part Dalit. Lo b'matana shenitna lo haaretz hazos. Not in the gifts of this land. V'lo b'kiran hashtar. Because I don't want to have to pay the debt of living in this land. Mipnei Yaakov achiv. When it says that Esav left because of Yaakov, Yaakov wasn't pushing him out. But what Yaakov was willing to accept, Esav was unwilling to accept. The challenge of living in Israel, of struggling with history, of living here when people don't want you to live, when you're accused of being apartheid, you know what that means. You're accused of being this, you're accused of being racist, you're accused of being bigoted, and you're accused of being imperialist, and you're accused, and you're accused, and you're... That's not something Esav wanted. He didn't want what Yaakov was willing to shoulder. That terrible but glorious mission of living in this land and being part of settling this land. He didn't want it. So that's why the Torah doesn't tell us where he went, because it's unimportant for this narrative. What's important for this narrative is he's running from Israel. And that's why, look again at pasuk number Gimel. That's why he left Mipnei Yaakov Achiv, line 3. He didn't leave because of Yaakov. He left in an area that Yaakov was unwilling to leave. Yaakov was courageous. Esau was a coward. Esau didn't want to shoulder that burden. And that's why the Pasuk says, source Gimel, line again, line 4, V'lo yachla eretz megurehem. What really frightened Esau was not that it was a land, hell, but it was eretz megurehem. It was the land of Avram, Yitzchak, and Yaakov. It was the land of the treaty, the land of vision, the land of history, the land of struggle. He was afraid of eretz megurehem. And guys, listen, because here's the punchline, and that's why the Gemara spends, guys, we're talking 54 psukim, describing Esav having children and wives, because you know what? That's all he did. He didn't want to be part of history. All he wanted to do was have children, wives, and find a quiet place to live. Esav discovers suburbia. He wants a mall. He wants manicured lawns. He wants stadiums. He wants to take his wives, his children, and find a land that he can live quietly in. So the Torah spends 54 psukim describing all Esav did was have wives and children, and he took all of them. His wives, his sons, his daughters, his cattle, his animals, his possessions, the things he bought, the knickknacks, the tchotchkes, the pet turtles, the china, took everything. And he ran from Israel in order that that homestead of his should remain intact, safe, secure. And he runs to a land, and we don't really care where he runs, he just runs. And then the Torah continues. Okay, now we've wiped Esav off of the historical stage. Now let's continue with history. Vayeshev Yaakov be'eretz meguri aviv. Yaakov lives in the land of his fathers, in the land of vision, in the land of dreams, in the land of struggle. So the point here is twofold, guys. Number one, it's so important to see the struggle for Israel, not only in geopolitical terms, in diplomatic terms, in international terms, but in redemptive terms, in historical terms. This is not a new struggle. You get fearsome, you get frustrated. Why are they protesting against us? Why are they protesting in the streets of Europe? Why does the UN have nothing better than to issue resolutions? Why is there so much anti-Semitism masked as anti-Zion? It's not new. It's something which HaKadosh Baruch Hu told Avram. It's not incidental. This is the Shara Shamayim. This is the place where history will end. I told you this when we traveled to Yerushalayim. This is, people know this will be the epicenter of the world. It's not, the struggle is not something, it's almost as if it couldn't have been otherwise. It could have been otherwise if our return to Eretz Yisrael were supernatural and immediate and quick and rapid, but it weren't Zalcha. The Gemara, and we'll talk about this in Mirtz Hashem after Pesach as we live through some of the Chagim of Geula, Yom HaTzmaut and Yom Yerushalayim. There are two different models for Geula. There's the A model where HaKadosh Baruch Hu sends Mashiach on clouds of glory, and it's supernatural and it's quick and it's painless, and everyone bows down and says, the Eda Kopo Keta Pialto, the Avin Kol Yitzor Keta Yitzarto, Hashem Oke Yisrael Melech. And then there's another version which we're living through because we weren't meritorious enough, we weren't privileged enough for that supernatural, quick, immediate, where Mashiach doesn't come on a cloud of glory, but comes in a broken donkey hobbling along on the rocks of the mountain. Yeah, you know, a donkey walk. He doesn't even walk like a horse, hobbling along slowly but surely, broken back donkey. And that's what we're living through. So don't be intimidated by it. Don't be fearful of it. Don't become overwhelmed by it. Now it's hard to look at the news, and they've got nukes, and they've got missiles, and they've got Eilev HaRechev, Eilev HaSusim, V'nachnu B'Shem HaShem Elokeinu Nazkir. And especially, I'm talking to both groups now, the boys that are in yeshiva, and the boys that have been here for a couple of weeks and will be here, and will one day hopefully come back. There's more Torah being learned today in the state of Israel than at any point since the first Beis HaMikdash was destroyed. I'm talking about close to 2,500 years ago. More Torah being studied today. 2,000. More Torah being studied today. So, Eilev HaRechev, Eilev HaSusim, V'anachnu B'Shem HaShem Elokeinu Nazkir. Don't be overwhelmed. Don't be frightened. It's part of living in Israel. It's part of living in Israel. Which brings me to my second point. Not every one of you will live in Israel. I hope you all will want to live in Israel, but not all of you will have the schus to live in Israel. But there's a major difference between not living in Israel and what Esav does dislocating from Israel, saying, I don't want to be part of it. I don't want to be part of that process. Esav runs from Israel. You can live in Seir. You can live in Johannesburg or Teaneck or Memphis. That's a formula that's too complex and too complicated for any Rebbe to tell you if you don't live in Israel, your life has come to an end. And you all come from communities in which people live meaningful lives. I would love to wave a magic wand if I could and say you all have to live in Israel. But I know the realities of life are different. The realities of life are not that way. The question is, can you live Israel even if you don't live in Israel? Can you be part of what's going on here? And here are some of the things to think about one day. One day, not now, but one day. I tell boys when they leave yeshiva, okay? Well, let me start with something Rav Amital told me. Rav Amital told me that when I leave yeshiva, my Rosh Yeshiva, when I open the newspaper every morning, the first thing I have to do is turn to the Israel section in the New York Times. Before I check the sports, before I check Facebook, before I check, it wasn't Facebook, it was 72 years ago when I was in, before I check sports, before I check finance. So when you open your browser, do you set your homepage to Eretz Sheva? Do you set your homepage to jpost.com? Do you set your, or, you know, your Facebook, do you post not just about what happened in the, you know, the Premier Soccer League, but you post about, you know, what's going on? Do you feel connected to this land? When you come to this land, do you stay in a hotel? Or do you take an apartment and you rent an apartment and live amongst the population and shop in the Makolah? I mean, I'll tell you, like in a cage. You're a tourist in a cage, going from cab to cab. You take an apartment, you dive with people, you shop with people. A lot of the boys here that have been here for the last couple of months know that's part of life in Grush, part of life in the yeshiva, is as best as possible you're part of the yeshiva, you dive in the yeshiva. That's part of what we want you to feel. Shabbos, you dive in the yeshiva. You dive in the yeshiva on Shabbos. When there's an off Shabbos, and you stay in yeshiva. Of course, no one would even have a Havamina that I met you daven with the yeshiva during a weekday. Of course, El daven at 7 o'clock. But that's a different story. As you boys all, no one here davens at the moment. Okay, you daven with the yeshiva when there's no yeshiva. Where was I? Yeah, I lost my train of thought. No, seriously, I've been talking about this for years and years, and you guys are probably in part products of this. Look at this. Look at the people that are joining us tonight and share. Here are kids in high school. You're in the end of your 10th grade, right? There's a tail end of your 10th grade and they're spending 3 months in Israeli high school. If I had 3 months, right? If I can wave a magic wand, I'd wish that every single North American in English high school were able to... Could you imagine if you had what you have now, if you had the exposure you've had over the last couple of weeks, if you had that in high school, if you were plopped into Mekar Chaim, if you were dumped into Charev, if you were thrown into Nativ Me, if you just had those three... Seriously. And some people do it on an individual basis. Some of the people from Toronto, Orion, and as we know, that some families in Toronto send their kids to spend, the Kaczynskis in Toronto, and it really changes the dynamic of their family and the dynamic of their kids' preparedness to be part of what's going on in the land of Israel. That's a tremendous, tremendous opportunity. Here it's becoming institutionalized, where you guys came in a group of whatever, 25 kids. But even if your school doesn't institutionalize it, send your kids to live with your uncle and with your brother and sister who live in Israel, or your sister and one brother, and have them spend time during the summer. I mean, even amongst you guys that are here, those of you that have been here summer in, summer out, again and again and again, have an easier time feeling part of the comings and goings. And those of you for whom this is your first time being thrown into a real Israeli, it's a whole epiphany. It's a whole... Come back, I tell boys, when you leave yeshiva, okay? Every 3 years, in my opinion. Sometimes I ask parents who visit their kids in yeshiva, when's the last time you're in Israel? And I feel like my heart falls when they tell me, oh, the last time I was in Israel, 26 years ago when I was in Michlala, or 25 years ago when I was studying in yeshiva. And I ask myself, how could you miss 25 years of Jewish history? How could you just miss it? You know how much the country has changed in the last 25 years? It's a different country. How could you sideline yourself? Now, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. Obviously, people have significant financial strains. They can't afford it. But if you're someone that travels on vacation, as most people do today. So, to me, there's no excuse that every third year you shouldn't be in Israel. Year number one, go to Spain. Year number two, go on your cruise to Alaska to look at the polar bears. Year number three, come back to Israel. Year four, go off to South America, to the Amazon. I'm not a travel agent, but if you want to give me some... Year number, go travel to, you know, the outer Congo to see the hippo. You know, go wherever. Year number six, you're back in the coastal. You're back in the coastal. How could you? How did I pick three? Because 3 years is a chazaka. and if you're outside of Eretz Yisrael for more than 3 years, if Chazaka, you're not a part of Eretz Yisrael. So this should, now again, if don't get me wrong, it's funny, you know, if El Al were here, they say, wait a second, you know, sign on the check, and you got to pay money to be an Israeli tag. You can't just walk to Israel, in Ethiopians, you can walk to Israel, and you go on a plane costs money. Okay, fine, if you can't afford it, you can't afford it. But many people in this room come from families and will be parts of families one day that really do travel from time to time, and even if it means struggling a little bit, that means you're part of being an Oved Hashem. Let me put it to you this way. It's not just how many block Gemara you learn, not just how well you daven, and as you now have discovered, it's how much you live this historical struggle, how much you're willing to live. And let's face it, in Baruch Hashem, we're living through a peaceful period, and we should continue to live through a peaceful period, and no one wants there to be terror, and no one wants there to be instability. But when it does explode, and it does explode because the Middle East is a powder keg, and one little traffic accident can ignite an entire powder keg, an entire explosion. And yes, it's more dangerous to live in Israel. And yes, it's more scary to live in Israel because we're all walking and to live in the Shtachim. Yeah, but do you accept that? Or do you worry only about how, you know, are you going to find yourself the same Eretz that Esav was looking for? You take precautions. No one should put themselves in the field of Sakana, obviously. Ain't some Chanelanes. So no one should travel. And to be honest, there were times during the Intifada where people stopped coming that to me I felt like you don't want to judge people, but it was either, you know, ignorance or cowardice. Because no one was living in bomb shelters, and as long as you took precautions, you know, the safest year to live in Israel, in the 63 years of the State of Israel, the safest year to live in Israel, upon average, was the height of the Intifada. Why? Because there were so many terror incidents that people stayed at home. Because people stayed at home, people drove less. And because people drove less, there were fewer traffic accidents. And even during the height of the Intifada, the amount of traffic casualties would triple the amount of terror casualties. Triple. Not double, triple. So the safest year to live in Israel, statistically, if you're just an average person walking down the street, the safest time to live in Israel was, okay, now obviously take precautions, and fear is fear. A lot of people don't go to Johannesburg because they hear all the crime, and you guys can tell them something else, that you guys are able to make sense of your world and make peace of your world. But Israel isn't Johannesburg. And if someone tells them, I don't want to go to Johannesburg because it's too dangerous, that's just ignorance. If someone says, I don't want to go to Israel because it's too dangerous, well, that's bordering on Esav. That's bordering on dislocation. So go to Israel, don't go to Shtachim. Go to Israel, stay in Israel, go to Israel. And just to take yourself out of play, and certainly when it's not dangerous. Okay, even if everyone says, okay, I'm not going to go during the danger periods because of the State Department's warning, but I'm going to go every time. We're far from people coming as much as possible to Israel, being part of Israel. But again, it's not just visiting. It's living Israel, identifying with Israel, speaking Hebrew in your home, introducing Israeli comings and goings into your religious fabric of experience. As I told you so many times, if I were the head of a principal, if I could wave my magic wand over North American education, and I had one choice to make, my first choice would be to integrate studying Israel as part of the Lumud Kodesh. Because you're trained to think that the Lumud Kodesh is Gemara, Halacha, Musar, Tefillah, and all that stuff. And then in the afternoon you learn Zionist history, if you're that lucky. So you don't even learn that. But you have to worry, you have to realize that, no, this is part of your firm pride. This is part of your neshama. This is part of your relationship with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, and with Avraham Yitzchak and Yaakov, and Eretz Megurehem. And when I see my bonus Hashem, I see it in terms of the Gemara I learn, and the tzedakah I give, and the fact that I'm living in a lunch spot. I'm trying to change history, and building a settlement where 40 years ago there was nothing. And I'm teaching in this yeshiva, I'm going to the United States tomorrow night to try to speak to boys about the yeshiva. And part of my desire is not just to get into this yeshiva because I think it's better for them and more compatible, but more boys that come to this yeshiva, the more consolidated our presence in Alon Shvat will be in Gush Etzion, the more that Gush Etzion is on the map. And that's part of the historical art. We're one of the only yeshivas that are in the Shtachim. I'm proud of it. I don't hide it from parents. Oh, by the way, we're in the Shtachim. No, we're proud to be in a settlement. We're proud that, and you guys should be proud of that also. And that's why the Torah wastes 54 psukim about Esav. Because that's all Esav was concerned about, his wives and his children. And Yaakov was attentive to Jewish history. And Esav ran, and Yaakov stayed. And Esav didn't run because of cattle. Esav ran because of historical challenge. And Yaakov was willing to bear the historical challenge. Yaakov was willing to be part of it. Okay. Let's see what else we'll talk about tonight in the 15 or so minutes which remain. Source number 2. Very interesting discussion about Dina. Dina comes up twice in the Parsha. Once explicitly in the text, the section you all know, where Dina gets embroiled with Shem, entangled with Shem, and of course it leads to a very, very dicey situation where the entire Shechem is massacred by Yaakov's children, Shimon and Levi. a bit deceitfully. We'll talk about that in a few moments. But there's an earlier moment which you don't see because you don't see Dina, but she's part of the story. What happens? Vayakam balaylahu. Okay, source number Aleph, it's a medrash, but the medrash quotes the pasuk, I had to shorten for space. Vayakam balaylahu. Yaakov is preparing for the encounter with Esav. Vayikach hashtei nashav. Takes his two wives. Vayashtei shechosav and his two secondary wives. And he arranges this whole hierarchy for Esav to meet. Esav is going to meet him in Taraj, in part to show Esav Kavod. He's not going to meet them all at once. Blue picture. He's going to meet Bishop Carmella, Bill and Zilpa. He'll meet Rachel and Leah. He'll meet his children. He'll meet Yosef. Meet them one by one. Hopefully he'll soften up Asa, take away some of his fury, some of his rage. But there's one person who isn't part of this entourage, isn't part of this greeting party, and that's Dina. Because he's taking his sons and his wives, and doesn't say his daughters, and Dina was his only daughter, at least at this stage. Doesn't say Dina. So Chazal say, source number two, V'dina heichan hi. Where was Dina? So you all know the medrash. Nasna b'teva. He locked her up. He hit her. V'nal b'faneha. Why? Well, it's obvious why. Because it's Esav. And she's a single girl. And Esav is a deviant. And I don't want a child molester, murderer, whatever else Esav was, hooking up with my daughter. So obviously I'm going to keep her in the back burner. Amar, he says, line 2, source 2, part Aleph, Harasha zeh, eino ramahi, his eye is very ambitious, he sees single women, he'll grab them, shelo yitla einev v'yir osa, he'll see Dina, v'yikach osa mimeni, it'll be an awkward situation. Trying to appease Esav, he's going to ask for Dina, I can't really say no, it's not really the shidduch I've been looking for. It's not really the person I want to call my son-in-law, my devious, murderous brother. It's not really someone I want as my son-in-law. Okay, makes sense. Yaakov should get schar for being so prescient, for being so careful, for being so vigilant. Rebbe Huna b'shem Rebbe Abba ha-koin baratel amar. Line number 3. Amar lo ha-kadosh baruch hu. Line number 4, the end of the line. Manata chastacha min avichucha. Yaakov, you made a mistake, you failed, you slipped up. This could have been Esav's great moment. He would have seen Dina fallen in love, she would have inspired him to reform his ways, to rehabilitate himself. You held one last opportunity for reform away from your brother. Because if he would have seen Dina, maybe a woman's touch would have done it for him. Manata, line 4, 2 Aleph, chastecha min achucha. You withdrew, you withheld chesed from your brother. Te'ilu isnasivas legavra, lo zinta. And the onesh is going to be, because you withheld Dina from Esav, your onus is going to be that Dina is going to get entangled with Shechem. Guys, what is going on here? Yaakov's being punished? Or Dina's being punished, not really punished morally, but punished in terms of the situation, because he withheld her from Esav? The answer is yes. And our relationship with Rishayim, even Rishayim like Esav, certainly people who aren't as big Rishayim as Esav, but maybe a little bit less than us, has to be calibrated along the boundary between those two values. On the one hand, there's the value of insulation. You should insulate yourself from negative influences. You should protect yourself against those who will inspire you to bad behavior. On the other hand, you should beam and radiate and broadcast strength and inspiration. And if you take yourself out of play and don't hang out with those lesser than you, then you may withhold from them opportunities to grow. Now, how do you draw the balance between this? And I know a lot of guys in yeshiva are thinking about this. How should I relate to my old friends who have taken different paths, who didn't come to Israel, who came to Israel and aren't so serious? How do I relate to them? I'm sure many of the high school kids, maybe. Did everyone come on this program? Not everyone came, right? Some came on different programs, different levels. So I'm going to go back, and all of a sudden, you know, I was a kfar boy. Now, there's a little tension, right, between the kfar and then the naksha on different programs. And had it, on the one hand, you don't want to come off as arrogant. You don't want to go and say, oh, we're the better boys, and we got the better program, and they had the lesser program. If you really want to be an Ovid Hashem, and you really feel that you gained this year, and you gained this kavod, and now you want to inspire people and say, well, look at that guy. He went on the kfar program,
And he still gives me the time of day, and he's still interested in my comings and goings, and he still hangs out with me, and he still tries, and he inspires me, and look at how he davens. On the other hand, you're still somewhat impressionable. You're in 10th grade, 11th grade, and somehow you can't just throw yourself open. Same thing with guys that are older. You're still impressionable. You're a little more stable in terms of your identity than high school kids because you're just a couple years older, but you're still growing. A lot of times guys have this question on secular campuses. How broad should my circle of friends be? Should I really try to interact with all the Jews, the non-Orthodox, the Reconstructionists, the egalitarian? Because after all, if they see me, what else will they learn about Orthodoxy? Okay, but ask yourself, are you in a position of strength? Having had 4 years of modern Orthodox Torah education, 1 year in yeshiva, are you ready to be an ambassador? Especially if you're on a college campus and you don't really have a strong, solid community of Orthodox Jews to back you up. Let's say a lot of the Israelis, just to give you guys a sense in Israel, a lot of the Israeli talmidim in the yeshiva, one of the big questions they're asking themselves now, some of them are going into the army this summer, summer here is July, August, some already went to the army. The questions they're asking themselves, should we be in separate units so that our minyan is strong, so that our Shabbos is pure, that our kashrus is unadulterated, or should we be in mixed units, not being mixed boys and girls, but mixed units with none from non-religious Jews, because this is really their only time to see Orthodoxy with a human face. Now there it's a whole different story. They've been in yeshiva for 2 years, they're going as a group, they're going to be 10-12 datiyim with a group of 10-12 non-datiyim. It's a Jewish environment, and their Judaism isn't under assault, it's their religion which is being questioned. If you're going to secular campus, part of the struggle is not just to maintain your belief in Orthodoxy, but you're under assault for being a Jew. Now, you're not in a Jewish environment. The terms are different, but it's very much the same structural question. But when you already reach the stage of Yaakov, then already Hashem has a good claim to Yaakov. Look, Yaakov, this isn't your first rodeo. You've been through the ringer. You're strong. You're sharp. You have your wives. You have your children. By showing Dinah to Esav, it's not all of a sudden that Esav's going to swing Dinah to his camp. You're probably going to swing Esav, if he falls in love with Dinah, into your camp. And as a community, I grew up in the Haredi community. I lived the Haredi high school education. And when I made my move into the Hesder world, one of the things that irked me was the separatism. That where I felt that the Haredi world, I don't know if it's true or not, but I felt it was building a world for itself. And if you follow the codes and you follow the rules, you're in. If you don't follow the codes and you don't follow the rules, you're out. And basically, we're not trying to include you, we're trying to include those who are similar and exclude those who will threaten our way of life. Which, I know, if someone wants that lifestyle, I have nothing against it, but I felt it wasn't me. I felt like I have to worry about a broader agenda. And when you worry about a broader agenda, you run the risk of dilution. And that's what Yaakov was struggling with. Adir, if you're going to have a school like an Ida Crown school in Chicago, who has a very, very broad agenda. Adir's school is, we have to worry about the Russians that have moved to Chicago. We have to worry about people who are marginally, or seriously, marginally attacked. So the school is going to be more diluted. Whereas a school like the yeshiva will not necessarily stretch its wings to include them, and the yeshiva, and which do you go for? Which you try to tackle. Depends upon the situation. And you guys are living through it in Yeshiva College and King David and then the Hirsch Lions on different sides. So it's a question that we ask ourselves as communities all the time. And the purpose and the message, guys, the lesson of Yaakov is not to be simplistic. Hashem felt, as ironic as it sounds, you probably learned this medrash when you were in high school as an applause of Yaakov. Yaakov was so careful that he hid Dinah. And you never realize, Chazal take him to task. Chazal are critical of Yaakov. This is not the moment to hide Dinah from Esav. This is the moment to try to embrace Esav. Because you have, not in the beginning of Vayetze, then Yaakov is alone. Then he's penniless. Then he's vulnerable. But the beginning of Vayishlach, look at what you have. Look at who you have. So I don't have answers for you. But just never be simplistic about that question. In the friendships now that you're going to recalibrate, again, I'd be very machmir at a younger age and much more makil at an older age. When you're still younger and you're still forming your identity, be careful. A lot of guys go back to the United States, to England, I'm going to go and proselytize, I'm going to go and preach, I'm going to be friendly with every Jew, I'm going to show them. And instead of showing, you're showed. And all of a sudden, instead of inspiring, you start to lose your conviction, lose your sense of standard.
and you lose a lot. So my vote would be during your younger years, not to be rude, not to be insensitive, but to tilt a little bit. But even when you're insular, the insularity shouldn't be obnoxious. The insularity shouldn't be arrogant. The insularity shouldn't be holier than thou. I sense in a lot of American high schools, and you guys can think about it, correct me if I'm wrong, there is a bit of a polarity between the good guys and the lesser good guys. And like, who are the good guys that I want to be with? And we're going to separate ourselves from the lesser good guys, make sure they don't, maybe in England also, I don't know, travel, but I sense it. It's very, very polar and very, very inappropriate. Because there's an edge to it. I understand that social circles dictate your development, but there's an edginess and a disparagement and a self-righteousness that I find a little bit ugly, and you really shouldn't feel part of that, even if you feel like you have to keep your friends. Okay, so you're not going to be best friends with the guy who's a little bit dangerous to your growth, but you pass him in the street, you say a nice hello, you're not rude to him, you don't make yourself, you try to be as embracing as possible to every single Yid, and you try to champion whatever Yiddishkeit they have in them, even if it's not as strong as yours, trying to make them feel good about themselves. Yes, you did something good. So you didn't daven well, but you know, you played well on the team, you know, representing the yeshiva, whatever, make them feel good about themselves. Yaakov doesn't give Esav a moment to feel good about himself. He hides Dina, who could potentially swing. The second moment of Dina is a little bit more classic, and this will end. Source number two, part base. Vateitze Dina Basleya. So she goes out, and she gets herself into hot water, she gets herself into trouble. And the Torah emphasizes the word Vateitze, part gimel, Velo Bas Yaakov. What do you mean Vateitze Leia Bas Dina? Dina Basleya. She's the daughter of Dina, she's also the daughter of Yaakov. Why is she referred to as the daughter of Dina? Her mother, you know, whenever you get in trouble, right? So what does your father tell your mother? Oh, your son is doing so-and-so. Your mother's wait, he's your son also. Your son is doing so-and-so. Whenever you get in trouble, it's always the other person's son. So here, Leah gets in trouble. Well, you know, who's writing the Torah? Yaakov? Oh, but Tetzei Dina Bas Leah. It was Leah's daughter that got into trouble. It wasn't my daughter. It's your daughter also, Yaakov. So Rashi says, Al shem yitziasa nikra bas Lea, because she was a yatzanis. She afhi yatzanis haisa. Lea was also someone who, you know, was a little too curious. You remember she had her flowers that Reuven gave her in Parshas Vayetze, and she wanted to find out where Yaakov was sleeping that night, and she found out, and she offered the flowers to Rachel, and she secured Yaakov, whatever. Okay, not the end of the world, but maybe a little bit inappropriate. But Lea gave that gene to Dina, and it was called the curiosity gene. And she was a yatzanis. She wanted to say, what's going on over there in Shechem? She was living with her father. It was very boring, cattle and more cattle. A couple angels here and there, that's exciting. But you know, once the angels disappear, it's more cattle, and Israel, and Zionism, and history, and vision, and all that boring stuff. Let's see what's happening over there in Shechem. So she walked around Shechem for a little spatzir, as we say in Yiddish. A little tiol to Shechem, and all of a sudden... So in 5 minutes or less, we hit another midah that you have to be very, very careful about on both sides of the equation. Your teacher probably told your mother, oh, your son, he's such a good boy. He's so curious, such intellectual curiosity. And that was a trait that you were commended about on parent-teacher's night. Oh, he's a curious lad. He likes reading. He gobbles up information. He doesn't just take things at face value. He's willing to ask questions. That's the predominant culture. You want to be curious. You want to leave no turn unstoned. I'm just teasing. No stone unturned. Leave no stone. Okay. It's only druggies who leave no turn unstoned. No stone unturned. I did it intentionally, Steiner. Okay? No stone. This is from my guess. That was our line. No stone unturned. Let's look at everything and discover everything. Okay, but curiosity also kills the cat. And we are very poor at drawing red lines in the sand and saying, Adkan curiosity, mikan vahala tahara, mikan vahala nikios, mikan vahala tamimus. You can't just let it all in and say, oh, I'm going to filter. Filter is the F word of modern life. Filter. At a certain point, your filter fails. And especially in today's world, where to be curious, you don't have to be a yatzanis like Dina. It used to be curious, you had to be a yatzanis. Well, I live in my own private world, it's clean, it's pure, it's protected. yeah, I'm going to go to the bar, I'll go to the, look at the dirty magazines in the candy shop, I'll hear it. But today you're sitting at your computer and you're two clicks away from Shem. And a lot worse. So this identity or attitude that you can't just celebrate or champion curiosity, exposure, the E word, exposure, see it all, learn about it all. Sometimes you just have to, and that's the great secret of the Haredi culture. Haredim who are intelligent know that by withholding computers from their environment, they're fighting a losing battle. I spoke to people who are willing to be honest. They know in 5, 10, 15, 20 years, you're not going to be able to live without a computer, without internet. But they've told me, look, at least I'm buying 20 years. At least I'm buying 20 years without imperiling my family with schmutz. So I know I'm going to have to concede one day, but it's a slow attrition, and I'd rather fight that war to the last drop of blood. At least, I don't say use those terms, but at least. And all of a sudden, we're the big... I'm the big, right? I'm not talking about we, iPhone and Android and computers and everything. Just let it all in. At some point, you have to be honest with yourself. And that's why when the boys in my shiur wanted to discuss the other night, should we own a TV when we get married? I said, I'm not even going to talk about that situation because in 15 years or 10 years when you start a home, it's not even going to be TV. I mean, TV is going to be obsolete. It's going to be a screen that will provide content through the internet, on demand. I mean, use the word TV is to make yourself obsolete. But yes, I do think that for my generation and for the current generation, yeah, it is an important question. We didn't just run out and buy cable in our house. We have a TV. We have two channels. We want to know what's part of going on in the country. We want to be able to watch the news. Part of the beginning of my shiur, I want to be able to live Israel and watch Rechman al-Islam funerals and celebrate the triumphs of our people and be part of my and I don't feel that a newspaper is enough and but we get the two base channels, really nothing, talk shows, politics, a game here or there, really nothing. But you know, throw 75 channels into a television and give a high school or even a grade school kid the clicker and the remote, you know what's going to end up happening. And like I said, in 10 years the difference between a remote and a mouse is going to fade. You know, it won't be mouse and mice either. It'll be, you know, just immediate clicking of immediate access to media. So this world that we live in, where curiosity is seen. Remember, every year when you read Parshas Vayishlach, curiosity killed Leah, killed Dina, killed the cat. And you have to be curious for sure. You have to be careful to know the boundaries of curiosity, and don't be afraid to say a little less curiosity. A little more tamimus, a little less curiosity, a little less knowledge won't be that bad. Let's go down.